This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
It's feeling like a Friday.
It's just odd.
Already.
It's really peculiar, isn't it? And I realise that not only is the day wrong, it's like that thing where, you know, if you feel jet lagged, I feel day lagged. It should be Friday, but it's Tuesday. And of course, what I've done is I've come in without a coffee for you.
Well, you can go out again then.
Well, I thought you needed me to fill the space in an entertaining and thrilling way.
No, that's true. Well, we'll find some.
You could send out for one, Simon.
Yes, I was going to make an inappropriate reference there. No, we'll find someone who's got nothing better to do than to supply broadcasters with coffee. I'm not sure there are any left, actually.
No, but that is usually my job, and I think, therefore, there will be a union issue involved if I haven't done it, but I'm afraid I haven't. But I haven't because it's Tuesday, and I get you coffee at 3:10 on a Friday.
Just to make this absolutely clear, in case you haven't already, it's because the Open Golf, which starts on Thursday, full coverage on 5Live, so we're doing our movies in just a moment. The podcast will be available. And I know that vodcast is going to be available because the lights have just gone on. I like to work in darkness normally, but then the neon lights come on just so that people...
But that's what reminded me. They came and they turned the light on and I thought, oh, bother, I didn't get his coffee. It is like Pavlov's dog. You know, somebody rings a bell and I start thinking I should have got you your caffeine.
It's 14 minutes past three. We'll take some travel, then we'll be doing a top 10 and some new movie releases as well to set you up in good time for the weekend. Mind you, you'll have forgotten by the time we get to Friday. So it's 3:15. This is 5Live. Close your eyes and pretend it's Friday. Here we go. We've got some movie reviews coming up for Buy It Now, Firehouse Dog, Private Fears in Public Place. Is it Public Place or Public Places?
Places.
These all sound like smallish.
Yeah,
because it's the summer. I went to the movies a couple of days ago and they said it's the summer of 2007, the best summer ever.
Yeah, that trailer. Have you seen it? Isn't it weird? Because you look at it and you go... Well, one of the funny things that's in that trailer, if anyone has been to the cinema, I don't know whether it's a particular chain that are doing it, but they're running this trailer and it is a whole lot of bits of movies that are released in the summer. But one of the things they've got is a clip from The Seventh Seal, which is out this week, which, of course, is, you know, the Ingmar Bergman classic re-release. One of the greatest films ever made. It's, you know, extraordinary portrait of, you know, Max von Sydow playing chess with death, you know, with the side which has been parodied in absolutely everything, largely the Woody Allen films. But it's weird because it's in amidst all this other, actually very, very moderate, mid-range, drecky schlock that's coming out. So suddenly you've got one of the greatest images in movie history. And it says summer of 2007. You think, well, not really. I mean, it's a black and white Swedish film by Ingmar Bergman.
One of our correspondents last week thought it was the 2007, the worst year ever for film, which doesn't really make a great advert, though, does it?
I don't think it's the worst year ever, but it has been one of those summers in which a number of people, it's not just critics, a number of people have said, blimey, is that all there is? And it is down to this thing about summer of sequels and threequels. I mean, by the time you get to a summer in which there's three, and then we still have Rush Hour 3 to come. I mean, you know, just think of the tragedy of that.
This summer?
Yeah, haven't we had Rush Hour 3?
No, I mean, you're the movie critic. You tell me.
No, I think we've only had. I know there is a
have
Rush.
Have you seen it or not?
Rush Hour 3?
Yes.
I don't think so. No, I mean, it's put it this way. I've seen more hours of Rush Hour than... No, I think Rush Hour 1 and Rush Hour 2 have happened. I certainly haven't seen Rush Hour 3 this summer. If it's happened, then it's, no, I'm sure it's Rush Hour 1 and Rush Hour 2. We are waiting for Rush Hour 3. I'm pretty sure. Please email me in if that's not the case. But it's Tuesday, and I will be, you know, in a slightly different frame of mind because it's Tuesday.
The box office top 10.
Oh, you can do that.
This what would you like me to do?
No, that's fine. I just like to know what you're doing.
La Vie en Rose at 10.
You know, it's not... Marianne Cotillard doing her own vocals, the argument being that nobody can sing like Edith Piaf. But I honestly think that what the film really needed was a coherent voice, and perhaps her singing would have given it to the film. And I also think that it is rather rum, not to say French, to do an entire movie about somebody whose life was 40-something years and leave out the whole of World War II. And I say this incidentally. I had people were saying, oh, that's, you know, you're just saying that whole thing, but only the French could, you know, say, oh, World War II didn't happen. Piaf had an interesting role in World War II. And it's, according to all reports, Piaf, who did sing for high-ranking German officers, also worked for the resistance. And one of the things she did was she visited prisoners who she had photographed with her. And the photographs were then used by the resistance to make passports for these people. So, in fact, there's a very brave chapter of PF's life to be talked about. And it just seems really contrary to make that movie and just say, oh, well, it just never happened. I mean, it's a big thing.
These are supposed to be brief summaries.
No, I know, but I'm answering a specific...
We've only got to number 10.
You know, the other ones are going to be shorter, because the other ones I haven't had people emailing me and say, how can you say that about the French? Well, you know...
Nakab, is it?
Yeah, well, now... Because we weren't shown this, but I looked up for reviews of it, and the only one I could find was on India FM, which says... It opens the most shocking thriller of the year, but then it says, with a tagline like that, you're expected to... That's the tagline. I'm afraid the best they can say about it is, to sum up, it's watchable fare. Terms like predictable and monotonous are non-applicable, and it is engrossing in parts. Now, if anyone's seen Nakab and can give us a more thorough rundown of it, please do email. I know that people have been emailing in reviews of the non-press shown Bollywood film, so please do.
At number 8, Molière, and Matthew says, Simon, could you tell Dr. Kermode that Molière is pronounced to rhyme with where?
How was I? Was Molière. I saying Molière?
Yes.
Was I?
Okay, and it's Molière.
It's Molière. And what did you say?
I said Molière.
Did you?
My mother being a French teacher.
Is your mother a French teacher?
She was a peripatetic French teacher.
All these years of me bad-mouthing the French, and yes. You've been sitting there not mentioning that your mother was a French teacher.
Well, she's not French, though.
No, but she's a French teacher.
It doesn't matter.
Okay, fine. Molière.
Molière.
It's Shakespeare in Love en français. Molière en amour. It's light and frothy, and it's like a Battenberg cake, but it's not much more than that.
Hostel Part 2 at 7.
One hopes that Hostel will be out of the top 10 next week. There was an interesting news story that I was emailed today, which said that Captivity did not have a captive audience. And in fact, it had done really badly at the box office and was going to ship up on DVD really quickly. And I have to say, I thought, good. I'm really glad that horrible, cynical piece of grot has done really badly. It's a shame that Hostel Part 2, which is a better made film, but, you know, it's like comparing different forms of warts, really. I mean, you know, one of them is better than the other, but it's a pretty level field. I'm just sad that Eli Roth is hanging out with Quentin Tarantino. I think the best thing anyone could do is take Quentin Tarantino and put him in a box somewhere and send him, you know, off.
Cynical levels of grot, though, do quite well on DVD, don't they?
Well, it'll do better.
That Sex, Lies and the Potato did okay on DVD.
It is alleged. Every time we say this about Sex, Lies and the Potato, Men was a stinker and it flopped. Oh, no, it made money on DVD. Rugsuckers from Mars apparently made money on DVD. I mean, it's really nothing to be proud of. Gonks Go Beat has just been re-released on DVD, the movie that I described as the Plan 9 from Outer Space of British pop movies, and that'll probably make money on DVD. So don't come around here telling me that actually we're wrong about Sex, Lives of the Pleasure Man because it took money on DVD, as the Film Council are so, you know, eager to tell us all, no, you shouldn't have financed it. It was a mistake. You should all be ashamed of yourself. And I mean, how can you do that and not finance Terrence Davis movies? I mean, seriously, Terrence Davis, one of the great British filmmakers, can't get a film financed, but you finance Sex, Lives of the Plato Men. Thanks, guys.
John in Luton, Rush Hour 3 is out on August the 10th.
Yeah, there we go. So I haven't seen it. That's good.
Ocean's 13 at 5.
You missed out number six, didn't you?
Well, it was Pirates.
Pirates.
Pirates of the Caribbean. I refer listeners to
Ikea
brands.
Knightley, Orlando Bland, Nest of Tables. That's enough. Ed.
Ocean's 13 at 5.
Julian Sands.
Fantastic Four, or just Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer at 4.
As I said, the comic book fans have sort of leapt to its defence. I don't think it has much to say about the Silver Surfer legend, and I think it is too shiny for its own good, although it's less bothersome than the first Fantastic Four movie, which really did trouble me quite a lot.
At 3, Die Hard 4 point less.
Yes, ba-boom, and I wish I'd made that gag. I mean, it's funny, people who go and see... I can't find anyone who actually thinks that Die Hard 4.0 is a good film, because it clearly isn't a good film. But there are a number of people who said, yeah, but it was 2 hours of Bruce running around and blowing things up, and it sort of did that all right. It's just a shame that when you compare it with the proper Die Hard movies, particularly when you compare it with Die Hard 1, which is a great film, Where Are My Detonators and Yippee-Ki-Yay and all that stuff, and it is a really, really good film. They showed it on television again the other day, and it's just, you can't turn it off. If Die Hard 4.0, you could turn off very easily.
Shrek the Third, is it number 2?
Would that it was the last of the Shrek movies, but it's not. Shrek the Fourth is due for 2010. I mean, I really feel that they have wrung every ounce of possibility out of this now. And again, the shame is, if you remember how great the first Shrek was, it's fine. I mean, Shrek the Third is okay. It's not terrible, but it's a real sort of decline from the first. I actually thought the second one was pretty good, and the second one was felt a little bit more subversive. This is now... DreamWorks have become what Disney had become. They've become the great big Leviathan that people will now take pot shots at, and they kind of deserve it.
The final book is out on Saturday, of course, and the latest movie is in at number one, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix.
Have you read the final book? I mean, because you're
out till Saturday.
No, I know, but you know, you're connected.
Have I seen an advanced copy? No, I didn't think so. No. I think you can say the security is quite tight.
Yeah, I hear that. Apparently, it is. Yeah, I mean, is it? Are there going to be any great revelations? She said that the last word is not going to be Scar. She said for ages. What's her name? Kevin Rowlands. What's her name? J.K. Rowling. Her. She was on television.
Two Rye A.
That's right. Yeah. That's what happens at the end. He joins Dexys Midnight Runners and goes on tour with him. She said for ages and ages the last word was going to be Scar, but now it isn't.
Wow, that really tells you absolutely everything you need to know. Anyway,
so the film itself is, you know, I think it's not great. I think there are good things in it. I think Yates is a good director, and I have higher hopes for the second one. I think the main problem with it is the plot feels like a holding pattern. There is not enough of the characters that I like. There's not enough of Jason Isaacs. There's not enough of Alan Rickman. There's not enough... I mean, although it's very dark and doom-laden, it doesn't have anything that's as horrifying as the killing of Cedric. It doesn't have anything like the beautiful cycle structure of Prisoner of Azkaban, which I still think is the best one. And I have to say, I think they're going to be hard-pressed to top it. But it is interesting that when you think back to just how bored I was by the first two movies, the Christopher Columbus movies, at least I now go in with high expectations. And I was thinking that is a major change. The fact that, because you remember when we first, I think it was in the first year that we did this show, when the first Harry Potter movie came out, I mean, I could care less. And you were saying, well, what's the Quidditch like? And I don't care. It's a bunch of kids flying around on broomsticks, you know. And actually, I did find myself feeling slightly nostalgic.
For the good old Christopher Columbus.
Not for the good old Christopher Columbus, but for a little bit of Quidditch, because there is some good Quidditch in the other ones, you know. The Christopher Columbus Quidditch is rubbish, because for a start, they don't look like they're actually doing it. It looks like really rubbish CGI.
You need to buy a book and read it.
Buy a book.
That would be a shocking thought. Mm. Anyway, so that's the top 10. That only took a couple of moments. What else might there be?
Well, because we're coming to things, let's start with Firehouse Dog. Let's change the order around, so because there's going to be more to say about Hairspray, and I'm aware that we're going to come up against the news, and you notice this is my production role. So, Firehouse Dog, it's the summer holidays. This is what happens when it comes to summer holidays. You get movies like Firehouse Dog out. In America, Firehouse Dog took something like $14 million, which is not very much money for a, you know, big kids movie. Story is, at the very beginning of the film, the setup is there is a Hollywood star who will not come out of their trailer, yeah, because they're pampered and they're, you know, generally looked after in Hollywood style. Gag is, the Hollywood star is a dog. Okay, so the deal is, he does the skydiving shot, the parachute doesn't get connected to him, he falls into a patch of rotten tomatoes, cue critics' gags about hand me those rotten tomatoes that I may throw them at the screen. He then gets adopted by a firehouse, the Dog Patch Firehouse, in which there is a young kid who's having a bad time with his dad, his mother has died a long time ago, his dad's brother, his uncle, died in a fire last year, therefore the firehouse is doing badly, there's father-son stuff which needs to be sorted out. Along comes this smelly, mangy mutt, but of course the mutt is actually a Hollywood action hero from movies like The Fast and the Furriest. Yeah, and that is quite funny, sorry.
That's all right.
No,
that's okay.
Raised a chuckle, right, okay.
And, that's the funniest thing you've said so far. This is the most interesting bit about the film.
Thank you very much. And so the rest of the thing is, you know, dog bonds with kid bonds with dad, fires get thing. I mean, incredible Basil exposition dialogue. You know, what happened in that last fire 3 weeks ago when the man went in? Do you think it's a firebug who possibly was the person who set fire to the building which your uncle, blah, 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 blah. Now, one could very cynically just say, huh, stupid dog movie for kids, but it's, you know, it's the summer holidays, and actually you want to know whether it, you know, what kind of stupid dog movie it is for kids. So I think the only way of judging it is this: it's not as good as Garfield, which is a cat movie, which I really didn't have any expectation of at all, but does have Bill Murray as the voice of the cat. But it is a lot better than Garfield 2, which I really didn't like, and I was really surprised that Bill Murray was as poor as he was in it.
What about Beethoven? Is it better than that?
No, I like Beethoven a lot. I think Beethoven is actually in a way, you've kind of preempted me, because Beethoven is the thing to which this aspires. Beethoven is genuinely funny for kids and for adults alike. It's not as tough or as gritty as that Greyfriars Bobby remake, which was done quite recently, which did have, you know, death and pestilence and hardship in it. And it's not as, you know, well done and nicely crafted as that Charles Sturridge remake of Lassie that was done recently, which had Samantha Morton and Peter O'Toole and those kind of people in it. But it's not completely without appeal. I mean, the thing I kept thinking was, if you're a 6 or 7 year old kid and you like dogs and you like stories about kids and dogs and you don't want to be offended, is there anything in it that's going to be a problem? Well, not really. I mean, the PG certificate says contains mild language, firefighting danger and crude humour. Now, the crude humour is that there's just endless stuff about doggy farts. And if several years ago, I would have said, oh, God, how cheap and nasty. But I have realised over the years that if you have dog movies for kids, the dog has to break wind, and it just works. I mean, it just does. Dog goes... And when I was making the Linda Lovelace documentary in New York, which was the most grim and depressing period of my life, it was really, really grim. It's a horrible story. I had to go and see Scooby-Doo in Times Square, right? Because it was coming out here, and I needed to see it beforehand. And I went, and I had an afternoon off, and I saw Scooby-Doo in Times Square with an entire audience of mothers and kids. And every time Scooby-Doo broke wind, the sound of these kids pealing with laughter, and it lifted my spirits. And ever since that experience, in the middle of this really grim documentary about this horrible thing that happened to this person, that I had developed a love of movies in which dogs break wind and kids laugh, because it's just funny, and the dog does break wind quite a lot and the kids will laugh at that happening. That said, it's the dialogue is terribly badly done, and it's not going to be memorable in the way that a movie like Beethoven would have been had you not stolen my thunder by bringing that up about 2 or 3 minutes ago.
It seemed an obvious comparison.
No, it didn't seem an obvious comparison, because I only arrived at it at the end of my list and I went, oh, good, Beethoven, I must remember that. And then, of course, you went and did it.
Instantly. It would occur to most. Craig, on this, when I saw the entertaining Die Hard 4.0 and I saw a trailer for Rush Hour 3. One, it's set in France. Two, it looks rubbish. And that's about as close as we've got to any kind of assessment.
That's great.
Of the movie.
Rush Hour 3, L'Heure de la Rush.
85058. mayo@bbc.co.uk. Still to come, reviews of...
Well, L'Heure de la Vite. That would be it, because that's fast, isn't it? Vite, toi.
Still to come, a review of Hairspray. Reassuringly, in English. Feel free to communicate with us. It's 5 Live. We're talking movies. In case you're wondering why, it's because the golf is here from Thursday. So we'll do Hairspray plus other movies between now and 4 o'clock. David Chandler, listening in Spain, says Harry Potter is out at the weekend. So how come my copy was shipped on the 13th of July and is due to arrive tomorrow? I think someone is being naughty. If he does get it, that will have broken a whole number of rules.
If he does get it, ring a newspaper, because isn't that a story?
Here's an interesting thing. Mayors in movies.
Mayors?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you remember the mayor in Jaws?
Yeah.
His name was Mayor Vaughan. Anyway, it turns out that this has been dug up by the... Because, like, you know, Boris Johnson said he wants to become... Mayor
oh, did he say he would?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't live in London.
It's only 24 hours old.
Sorry, was it in Southampton? No. Is Southampton getting a new mayor? No. Does it bother me in any way? No. As you were.
Was it on national radio, national television and in all the papers? Yes.
Was it on the film pages? No.
Anyway, welcome back to the real world. It turns out that Boris Johnson's favourite politician of all time, this is according to Labour, have been digging around on this, it's Mayor Vaughan.
From
Amity, the mayor of Amity. Yes.
Is that, so it's a gag, right?
Well, no, apparently... No, he chose him. Apparently he chose Mayor Vaughan as his favourite politician of all time because he chose to do nothing when surrounded by hysterical experts, and he quite liked that.
Yeah, OK, the whole...
But I mean, mayors in films are always venal, stupid, corrupt, idiotic or criminal.
Well, because in the case of Jaws, he is all of those things. Yes. And the whole point is it's because the mayor does nothing while all around him are actually right. And, of course, what happens is the mayor causes the beaches to be opened, which causes the tragedy of the Kintner boy, which causes Roy Scheider to have to go out and fight the great white shark. And, of course, of all the characters, he is probably the most corrupt. So either Boris Johnson is being, you know, deeply funny and sardonic, or he hasn't quite realised just how venal and evil that character is.
Just on your comments on Harry Potter, Tracy in Brentwood says, I found Professor Umbridge's treacle evil very scary and sadistic. Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah, she is great.
Highly entertaining. Do you know the problem is?
What?
Having watched it a second time.
Oh, yeah, go on.
Is that Helena Bonham Carter, fantastic, very good.
Yeah.
It just reminded me of Cherie Blair all the time.
I know.
Watch it again and enjoy.
But I mean, no, it's absolutely true. Imelda Staunton is fantastic. And I wouldn't say don't go and see it. Of course, go and see it. And it is worth seeing just for Imelda Staunton. And the scene in which she gets him to do lines is really creepy. But she's fantastic. You know, you think from Vera Drake to that, she does everything. Whatever she does it full on, and She is a great, great actress.
Hairspray would be the headline-grabbing movie of the weekend.
So, such a peculiar thing we're in now. Okay, Hairspray, the film, is based on the multiple award-winning Broadway musical, which was itself based on the not multiple award-winning John Waters movie from the 1980s. So it's like The Producers. It's gone from screen to stage and then back to screen. You remember in the case of The Producers, that did not work out well. Producers, great Mel Brooks film, apparently very, very good stage show, totally rubbish film of apparently very, very good stage show. In the case of this Hairspray, the original Hairspray, quirky, offbeat, indie, is at the point at which John Waters was becoming very mainstream because he started out as Trash Maestro. And, you know, good film. Then apparently a very good stage show. I didn't see it, but it won loads and loads of awards. And now back to screen. So it has a difficult pedigree ahead of it. The story is 1962 Baltimore. A teenager, Tracy Turnblatt, wants to be on the Corny Collins Show, which is a sort of dancing show for kids. Two reasons why she can't do it. The first is she believes in integration, and the whole area is completely white, except for what they have as what is called Negro Day, in which they're allowed to play black music. And the other thing is she's plump. She's of a larger size. So she's classic John Waters character, in fact, misfit, because actually all his films are about the revenge of the misfit, the people on the outside becoming the heroes. What happens is she finally gets the chance to have her dream when they have an audition and she goes along to it. And of course, as you can imagine, this being the story that it is, things work out and the misfits in the end come to rule the day. Now, the original was directed by John Waters. John Waters was a famous trash maestro who made things like Female Trouble, Pink Flamingos, Desperate Living, in films that really, really were incredibly edgy, gave us, you know, poop eating and all that sort of stuff. And somebody once said, you know, who are these people? Where do they go when the sun comes up? Isn't there a law or something? I mean, that was the level of outrage that those films created. This remake is directed by Adam Shankman, who's famous for helming a load of old poop, frankly. Films like The Wedding Planner, The Pacifier.
An awful lot of poop.
I'm sorry, it's not my fault. It's just that happens to be the week that we are. Cheaper by the dozen too. I mean, you know, that's...
So that from as well?
From John Waters to Adam Shankman, not great. Now, the original also starred Divine, a famous fat transvestite who caused gay disco to become, you know, very, very... He did a brilliant version of You Think You're a Man. You remember that? Which is absolutely
really
great. You're Really a Boy, which is also a remake of an old 50 song, which is a great song. This stars John Travolta, fat transvestite. Well, slightly porky. Not a transvestite the last time I looked, although he does, of course, you know, dress up as a woman in this film, who, of course, famously made disco famous with his Saturday Night Fever. And although, frankly, I would rather listen to the Divine version of You Think You're a Man than some of the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. Although I quite like Saturday Night Fever.
Night on a Disco Mountain. Who could ask for more?
Exactly. A fifth of Beethoven. both versions starred in the central role, an unknown, in the original, Ricky Lake. And, of course, look what happened to Ricky Lake. She became Ricky Lake. This time, by a weird verbal coincidence, Nikki Blonsky.
She didn't become Nikki Blonsky.
Well, I think she's probably going to be. Anyway, here's a clip starring the person who isn't Ricky Lake and the person who isn't Divine. And here's an interesting question.
Nikki Blonsky?
And the other one's John Travolta. What accent do you think John Travolta is doing? Now, the other voice that you probably recognised in there was, of course, who was the other voice?
I've got no idea.
It was Christopher Walken.
Was it Christopher Walken?
Of course it was Christopher Walken.
I should have recognised that because I saw him in the trail.
Yeah, Christopher Walken.
It was Christopher Walken then.
Christopher Walken playing a role which in the original is played by Jerry Stiller, who in this version plays Mr. Pinky, who runs the Hefty Hideaway, which is where they go to get their clothes for the larger person. Queen Latifah takes over from Ruth Brown as Motormouth Maybelle, and then John Waters himself gets a cameo, and it's a very brief cameo, as the friendly neighbourhood flasher. And then in the role that was originally done by Debbie Harry, this is so bizarre, Michelle Pfeiffer plays the role that in the original was played by Debbie Harry. Meanwhile, Debbie Harry's songs have become the backbone of a musical version of Desperately Seeking Susan on stage. So it's like all films are now producing musical stage productions, even if the stage production has nothing to do with the film at all. I mean, Mamma Mia was one thing, and the Queen musical, which got a character in it called Scaramouche Fandango, written by that dimwit Ben, what's his name, Thingy Bob.
Him. It's Ben Elton.
Him, yeah.
He's not dim either. You might not like him.
Yeah, let's just
move
on swiftly. Anyway, so all this kind of bizarre blancmange of stuff happening, going from what was in essence a really fabulously trashy thing, now this great big Broadway thing, and now back into a very, very mainstream kind of thing. Does any of it work? Well, yes and no. On the upside, the songs are quite jolly. The songs are quite nicely done. I mean, I laughed out loud quite a few times. there is something. I mean, it's a lovely story because it's, you know, obviously it's very sort of soft racial politics, but it's done very nicely. He does have a great way of doing outsiders all great. People who are, you know, the white waspy people are all absolutely terrible. And one of the things about John Waters, for somebody who started out being seen as the scourge of society, somebody who was going to bring about the collapse of civilization, his heart is solidly in the right place. And even though this is a long way away from the original John Waters Hairspray, it still has that sense of, you know, it's rooting for the right people. And it does that really well. And the dance numbers are well done. The director, the guy who made these terrible films before, it turns out, actually was a choreographer and has done some quite successful choreography. And clearly, the whole thing is directed with the choreographer's eye. And it's not badly put together at all. Now, Nikki Blonsky is terrific. It wouldn't surprise me at all if she does turn out to be the next Ricky Lake. Ricky Lake, incidentally, gets a very fleeting cameo as somebody who isn't Nikki Blonsky, which is sort of reverse in-gag funny for those of us old enough to remember that Ricky Lake started her career in John Waters movies. Christopher Walken is Christopher Walken. The weird thing about it is, for a song and dance film, Walken doesn't do very much dancing, which is strange.
Because he can.
Yeah, I mean, he's really an extraordinarily peculiar dancer. I mean, he's, you know, he's rubbery and bandy and all that kind of way. And what's the Fat Boy Slim track that he dances to?
I can't remember, but it's a fantastic
that
video.
One. It is
you
good.
Look very camp when you do an impression.
When I do that, what you mean? Yeah. And the other thing about Christopher Walken, of course, is he has fantastic hair. Doesn't matter what film he's in, his hair is always completely the same. So his hair's there, but there's not enough dancing of him. Travolta, however, is really, really weird. And it is saying something when, you know, a fat, poop-eating transvestite like Divine is less weird than John Travolta. Because John Travolta gave me the creeps. I mean, not necessarily in a totally bad way, but there's something really, really strange about his performance and his manner and his everything about him. Not that that's necessarily to the detriment of the film, but it is very, very odd. My main criticism is this. Original film, 92 minutes. This version, 117 minutes, and it should have been 92 minutes because it needs to be tightened up. But you know what? It's fun, and in a summer in which it's really not been very good, it's not... It's perfectly fine. It has very nice things going for it, and I did smile through an awful lot of it. The thing I'm looking forward to more, however, is they're making a musical of Cry Baby, which John Waters made with Johnny Depp, which is absolutely wonderful, which I really love. I think it was only 87 minutes in the original version, but that is going to be a musical. That'll probably then end up being another film as well.
More movies to come.
Are you bored with me? Because you're sort of rolling your eyes at me.
No, we've just got to do some Tour de France, which is happening now.
Okay.
Is that all right with you?
A Tour de France. That's what people say when they really like a film. It's a Tour de France. It's an Arc de Triomphe.
Not everyone's got it. This from Confused in Chandler's Ford. Simon, I've just ordered pizza and popcorn on hearing Mark's voice as our Friday treat. P.S. The kids are happy, which is reassuring.
It's nice.
Always nice to know. Yeah. Dominic in Rugeley, I thought... This is on Helena Bonham Carter in Harry Potter 5.
On the cardboard
I thought her portrayal of Bellatrix Lestrange was less Cherie Blair, more Amy Winehouse. And there is a kind of a hair similarity.
I haven't seen Amy Winehouse. I know her name, but I don't know what she looks like.
She looks a bit like Bellatrix Lestrange in Harry Potter 5.
Is she a goth singer?
No, she's not a goth singer, no. We haven't got time. There's plenty of time to do movies. Don't forget the podcast is available. The vodcast is there as well. Go to the 5 Live website for details. What else is new?
Two documentary-like things. Now, firstly, Buy It Now, which there's been a lot of controversy about. One of the things I try to do is to see films without reading reviews of them, and occasionally that can throw me a curveball. Buy It Now is a faux documentary about a teenager who auctions her virginity on eBay. And the first half of the film, well, there's two halves of it. The first half is called documentary. The second half is called drama. One half had apparently played in Cannes in 2005, the drama half, and won the Cine Foundation Prize. I didn't know anything about this at all. And I have to say, it was a very peculiar experience watching the first half, which appeared to be a homemade documentary about a really, really messed up teenager self-harming and having a really terrible time and lousy time with her parents. I kept thinking, this isn't real. I'm sure this isn't real. It's too, you know, it's too melodramatic. It's not possible that it's real. And yet, I have to say, it is a credit to them in a peculiar way that I really wasn't sure, and consequently, I felt distinctly uncomfortable about the whole thing. The second half then tells the story again in a kind of homemade drama way. And on the one hand, it's kind of reassuring because it's like, okay, fine, I know where we are now. On the other hand, I'm not sure exactly what that adds. There is an argument made. Antonio Campos, who's made this film, has clearly done it. It's an interesting experiment on two different ways of telling a story. There are some things to be said about teenagers, and there are sort of sly gags, like the fact is that this teenager thinks that Paris Hilton is a really good thing, and there's a kind of perhaps a comment on our, you know, adolescent society. Anyone who could look up to Paris Hilton, that things are obviously going badly wrong. I don't know that it's a brilliant piece of work. It is an interesting experiment. I'm not entirely sure the two halves work fully well together. It has a sort of Blair Witchy, is it real, isn't real quality to it. And although the central performance is convincing, is Chelsea Logan, is the girl who acts it. I thought, you know, she was convincing enough to convince me. I wasn't sure at the beginning whether I was watching a documentary or not, but I was thinking, in terms of Blair Witch, I mean, remember what happened, or rather what didn't happen to Heather Donahue. Moreover, remember what didn't happen to American Sanchez. They made that film, and then they didn't then follow it up with anything else. I mean, the Blair Witch makers just all kind of disappeared. So it'd be interesting to see whether Antonio Campos does anything more substantial in the future. I don't know that I would recommend it to anybody. I think it was an interesting experiment. I did feel extremely uncomfortable about the whole thing. The other
that, because you reminded me, in that diatribe, this from Jonathan.
It wasn't a diatribe. I thought it was a balance. I was trying very hard to be balanced.
What does Mark know about this new J.J. Abrams movie that has been trailed in the States? It has no title other than a code name, Cloverfield, and it seems to be a cross between Blair Witch and Godzilla.
No, don't know.
Ring any bells?
No, none at all.
Could you do some work on that?
I can find out for you, yeah. But I mean, I'll have to see Rush Hour 3 first.
Could you get back to us before 4 o'clock?
No, it's 3 minutes to. I don't have access to the internet. I make this stuff up. I mean, you know, you think I have a computer feeding me this stuff? You're the person with the computer. You Google it.
Do another film.
I'll do Ghosts of City Salai while you Google that, okay?
Okay.
Ghosts of City Salai actually is a documentary following gangsters in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and it's a very peculiar affair. It's about these gangsters who are originally propping up the Aristide regime. Then during the course of the documentary, Aristide gets toppled. Suddenly these gangster brothers, they're not sure where their allegiances lie. And on the one hand, in its favour, it's clearly shot in circumstances of extreme danger, and it is right there and intimate with these gangster characters. On the downside, the problem with it is, I don't know that it doesn't end up saying, you know what, gangster life may be quite glamorous if looked at in a certain way. I mean, one of the gangsters calls himself Tupac, the other one calls himself Billy. There's a central character who is a French aid worker called Lele, and during the course of the film, she actually falls in love with one of the brothers, and it's very hard not to think that the filmmakers themselves kind of fell in love with these incredibly unlikable characters who are, you know, gangsters, and there's endless images of, you know, gun-toting kids and squalor and deprivation and death, but it's all played out with a soundtrack because the gangsters keep getting on the phone to Wyclef Jean because actually what they really want to be is rappers. So I don't know that it's as good as, for example, a film like Favela Rising, which took a similar subject about slums and gang culture and music as a way out of those slums. And had me, maybe it's just that I'm, you know, somebody who believes in redemption and all that stuff, but I like the fact that Favela Rising had a purpose, had a cause, and ended up saying, you know what, music can defeat all this stuff. It may just be that I'm naive, but I wasn't overly in love with Ghosts of City Salai, and I did spend a lot of time thinking, I wonder whether they are rather too involved with this subject, and I wonder whether I'm learning anything from it. But it was convincingly horrible and clearly shot under incredibly difficult circumstances. And the other thing I want to say about this week is this re-release of Seventh Seal has come out, and as you said, it was trailed, and Seventh Seal is one of the greatest films ever made. And even if the only segment of it you know is the segment in which Max von Sydow plays chess with death, and it's been parodied so much, I mean, people will know Bergman's movies almost mainly through Woody Allen, but it really is one of those things, it deserves to be seen. I saw it again the other day, and you just think, there are few timeless filmmakers who, you know, make films that really deal with religion and ethics and death and politics and all those things, but can do so in a way which is poetic and engrossing. And it is a wonderful piece of work.
And movie of the week?
Well, I think it's Hairspray, but it's not a great week.
Oh, you're not sure, are you?
No, I mean, it's Hairspray, you know. James King saw it twice and he liked it and he's 12.
Mark, thanks very much.
Well, I think it's a 15 certificate.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.